Good morning, everyone. We're going to get started, so I'll call to order the Senate Committee on Judiciary, and we're going to start with our, and we're going to start with the bill that we've carried over, which is Senate Bill 30 in August. Okay, I think we've got attention now. And we have three people that were scheduled to give testimony on Senate Bill 30. And Vi, once you come up, Daryl and Gail, I think the three of you are the ones that have signed up. While they're coming up, and Gail just walked out, I guess. Oh, there she is. Is there anyone else who will want to testify on Senate Bill 30 today?
I haven't seen them yet.
Whoever would like to get started.
No.
Assuming it's going to be either Vi or Daryl, because Gail wants to play the closer since she's against the bill.
Chair Pozanski, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Vi Beatty. I'm the manager of the Sex Offender Registry with Oregon State Police. I've been in that position for the past 8 years. I'm not sure if we have the Dash 1 amendment ready yet, but the original bill added luring a minor, coercion, and conspiracy with intent to commit a sex crime to registerable offenses, and there were multiple reasons for that. A lot of it had to do with persons who move into Oregon from another state where we have to equate the crime to an Oregon registrable offense, and we were unable to do that because we did not have additional crimes to pull from. So we were getting some feedback and some questions from other state registries as well as the Indian tribal registries and the federal government on why those crimes were not involved. So we looked at adding them. Additionally, we then sat down with the district attorneys, the Sheriff's Association, questioned the chiefs, talked to the community corrections directors, SOSN, Sex Offender Supervisor Network, and the Criminal Defense Lawyers Association to see if we could meet on some central ground. And all but the criminal defense lawyers agreed that we would take coercion off the table. That would be in a Dash 1 amendment. Leave conspiracy because it does require two people at least to work together against a victim for a sex crime. And then luring a minor, we agreed that the language would state that the person reasonably believed the minor to be under the age of 16. Now, luring a minor states that a person either uses visual representation or explicit verbal language and description to induce a minor to engage in sexual conduct. According to the Community Corrections Directors Association and Supervisor Sex Offender Network, persons convicted of luring a minor currently are placed on a supervised sex offender package. So they must undergo a psychosexual evaluation. They must attend sex offender treatment. The only difference between this group of convicted persons and persons convicted of a registerable sex crime is the registration aspect. So we are in support of the Dash 1 amendments as they come out to add luring a minor if the person reasonably believes the person to be under the age of 16 and leaving conspiracy on the table but removing coercion. So the group had agreed to that. I'm available for any questions.
All right, let me go ahead and take the rest of the testimony and then we'll figure out where we go from there.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Daryl Fuller on behalf of the Oregon State Sheriff's Association, and in this case also on behalf of the Oregon District Attorney's Association. The reporting requirements for a sex offender registry seems almost to be an art as much as it is a science to try to make sure that the right people are registered and that people that don't necessarily need to be registered aren't, because we want that list to be useful and helpful not only to law enforcement but to the public. We believe in this case that the adjustments that are going to be made through the Dash 1 amendments as part of a work group to decide where to go is an important change to the sex offender registry. We understand the nature of the opposition from the Defense Lawyers Association wanting to have some room to negotiate, and we want that opportunity to be there, and especially in cases where there isn't strong evidence and you need to have the ability to negotiate a plea. But nevertheless, the ones that we are leaving or adding to the sex offender registry, we believe are significant enough crimes that they need to be included in the registry, and I'll be happy to answer any questions you have.
Right. Thank you. Gail?
Thank you. Chair Prasansky, members of the committee, Gail Meyer on behalf of the Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. We definitely like the Dash 1 amendment, much improved over the original bill. What our concern is both the crime of luring and coercion right now are what practitioners call safe havens to negotiate really, really difficult, hotly contested cases too. They are both C felonies. But when you have really hotly contested cases and you go through the settlement process and the settlement judges are with you, these are the two crimes that the parties can agree to, and the state agrees only when it's appropriate for the state to do so. Very frequently, negotiating these cases to a non-registrable offense is what creates the deal. And our interest is in keeping these two crimes available for that purpose. The only other optional crime really is a harassment, which is a B misdemeanor, and that very frequently is too low for the state's interests. They want to have felony adjudication for the reasons that Ms. Beatty testified to. You can have your full packet of sex offender treatment along with the sentence associated with it, but a non-registrable offense. Rarely are these the original charges, luring and coercion. These generally, if you look at the data, these are negotiated resolutions. Over on the House side, they're looking at the registry quite a bit. Big debates there is whether or not we should tier the registry according to risk. And the idea is for the true low-risk offenders, calibrating the registration requirement according to the level of risk. So these cases get resolved because the risk is proven to be low. It's landing on these C felonies gives the state what the state needs. It gives the defense what the defense needs, and we would just simply like to keep them in a robust fashion. We do not object to making criminal conspiracy a registrable offense. It's just not one of those safe havens that the parties generally seek out.
All right, thank you. Questions? I've got a question regarding the Dash ones. Since I've not seen them, and I don't know if I heard this in the testimony, would this be mandatory registration, or would this be discretionary, optional with the court, meaning the judge making a decision based on a case-by-case basis?
Our understanding is it would be mandatory, Chair Prasansky.
All right. So since the parties are working on this, we don't have the Dash 1s, I would like for you to consider whether we can achieve an agreement if it was discretionary with the court based on a case-by-case basis, understanding the concerns that have been raised as to reaching resolution cases that may be more difficult, but at the same time giving the flexibility where it may be appropriate. Any other questions or comments?
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Again, I'll ask, is anyone else who wanted to give testimony on Senate Bill 30? Not seeing anyone. We'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 30. We're now going to open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 40. And Mike, can you give us an overview, please?
Yes, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 40 reduces manufacture of marijuana from a Class A felony to a Class B felony. It reduces possession of marijuana from a Class B felony to a Class C felony. It makes marijuana the same as other Schedule II controlled substances, declares an emergency, and effective upon passage. There is a Dash 1 amendment as well as a Dash 4 amendment that break out even further the different weights and how they would be punished.
All right. We have a number of people who want to give testimony today, and based on the way I'm reading the sign-up sheet, I'm going to ask the following three to come up first: Lee Berger, Gail Meyer, and Daryl, why don't you come up as well? I'll take those three first, and then we'll take the next two. my understanding that this is still a work in progress, meaning we do not have a final draft of amendments at this point. And if that's the case, I'd like to have whatever needs to be put on the record regarding where we're at, so we, the committee kind of knows where we're potentially going.
Thank you. Chair Przanski, members of the committee, Gail Meyer on behalf of the Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. We initially proffered Senate Bill 40 to do a very simple technical correction and simply make marijuana crimes reflect the fact that marijuana has now been scheduled a Schedule II drug rather than a Schedule I drug. And so it, specifically with respect to possession of marijuana of more than an ounce, it would reduce it from a B misdemeanor down to a C, B felony down to a C felony. That was our bill originally. It's proven to be a good vehicle for the more robust conversation about whether or not there should be a misdemeanor marijuana tier. Because as our current laws stand right now, if you have less than an ounce, it's a violation. If you have more than an ounce, it's a B felony. If you were to take our bill, Senate 40, in its original form, it would be less than an ounce to a C felony. Big jump between a violation and a C felony for possession of marijuana, and many states have a middle tier. The Dash 1 has multiple tiers, and in all candor, that's generated a lot of pushback. And so I think the current debate, Chair Przanski, as best as I am informed, it's taking place, is whether or not the appropriate tier, if we were to do just one tier, one misdemeanor tier, should it be at a B misdemeanor level or an A misdemeanor level? OCDLA would highly encourage everyone to start talking about a B misdemeanor as the appropriate level for the tier. And the reason is it's evenly calibrated between a violation and a C felony. A C felony in any event could be declared to be a misdemeanor, in which event it would be an A misdemeanor. So to have your tier at an A misdemeanor would almost be redundant to authority that the court would have in any event. So we think the appropriate level is a B misdemeanor. And with that, we know that interested stakeholders have different thoughts about the appropriate quantity that should be included in that B misdemeanor. Consistent with other states, there's good logic to make it up to 8 ounces. There are those who are uncomfortable with that quantity. So that's the current debate, Mr. Chair.
All right. Darrell.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Darrell Fuller on behalf of the Oregon State Sheriff's Association. In consultation with my colleague, we are in support of Senate Bill 40 as a technical fix to an issue, and don't have any problem with that bill. When you start talking about the amendments, I suspect strongly that the sheriffs will oppose any of the amendments in some cases entertaining discussions with sheriffs over shifting possession of larger quantities of marijuana down from a felony to a misdemeanor. A strong contingent of the sheriffs simply don't have any interest in going there at all whatsoever. So we've been a party of group emails that have been going around looking for some middle ground, and we're participating in those to the degree that we're able to do so, but ultimately I suspect that the sheriffs will end up opposing any amendment that degrades the penalty for possessing what we consider to be large amounts of marijuana. And I'll be happy to answer any questions you have.
All right, thank you. Lee?
Chair Przanski, members of the committee, my name is Leland Berger. I'm a lawyer, I'm an OCDLA member, but I'm appearing today on behalf of Compassionate Oregon. OCDLA requested the pre-session filing of Senate Bill 40 at my request, but Compassionate Oregon had developed a proposal regarding some misdemeanor provision. And initially we had recommended that the less than an ounce law for a violation be increased to 4 ounces, consistent with the decision from the Alaska Supreme Court interpreting their privacy provision in their state constitution that permits 4 ounces with no penalty in the home. We had a three-tiered system because we were recommending 24 ounces as a C felony. because that's the amount that OMA patients can possess. It made sense to us on in that regard. We're aware of the -1 amendments. We haven't seen the -4 amendments, but I'm assuming that they reflect what Ms. Myers testified to about the 8-ounce cutoff. We agree that in consultation, although not directly with the sheriffs, indirectly with law enforcement as a community, that it makes more sense to have a smaller number than 24 ounces for a C felony. And with that, it makes sense to have a single tier in the misdemeanor level. And to be more precise and following up on Ms. Myers' testimony, Oregon law provides that with the exception of sex offenses and domestic violence offenses, that Class C felonies can be reduced either by the prosecutor at charging or by the judge either at sentencing or at the completion of the probationary term to an A misdemeanor, and that's why it makes sense to make it a B misdemeanor. In response to the, and then the other thing that was really interesting with the -1 amendments is that it separated out marijuana from, which is not hashish, from marijuana which is hashish. And current Oregon law only does that for less than an ounce. It's less than an ounce of marijuana, not hashish. Marijuana hashish is automatically a felony. Our view is that leaves one of two possible interpretations, either any quantity of marijuana that is hashish can be prosecuted as a violation of the unlawful possession of a Schedule II controlled substance, or hashish is legalized. Again, as with the marijuana itself that's not hashish, it doesn't make sense that there isn't a marijuana that is hashish misdemeanor as well. Frankly, it's a concentrate that both is used by patients and recreationally. It involves, it's because it's a concentration. It's kind of although it's difficult analogizing alcohol to and the regulation of alcohol to the regulation of cannabis. It's kind of like the difference between a beer and bourbon. So it's not that it shouldn't be regulated, and it's probably appropriate to regulate it differently. And one place I think where there's broad agreement in terms of reaching a number, both among producers and among those in law enforcement that I've spoken with, is that it's roughly a 4-to-1 ratio. That it takes about 4 ounces of marijuana to produce an ounce of hashish. So our view is that, again, that we should increase the less than an ounce to less than 4 ounces and make 16 ounces a Class C felony, and in between 4 and 16 ounces a B misdemeanor. And for hashish, a quarter of 4 is 1, so less than an ounce of hashish would be a violation. Between 1 ounce and 4 ounces would be a B misdemeanor, and more than 4 ounces would be a C felony. Now, historically, among law enforcement, the sheriffs have been the most adamant prohibitionists. They refused to issue, you may recall, they refused to issue concealed handgun licenses to patients because they were patients, even though they were rebuffed in the circuit courts in Washington and Jackson County, in the Court of Appeals, in the Supreme Court, and the United States Supreme Court denied cert. But the fact is that tomorrow afternoon, in the House Judiciary Committee, they're going to consider House Bill 3371, that's a legalization proposal. And if it doesn't pass this session, it'll pass at the next electoral cycle or the electoral cycle after that, because when last asked, 47% of the people thought that unlimited possession and unlimited cultivation was okay. That's what happened in Measure 80 last fall. So I think in assigning, as uncomfortable as it may be for the sheriffs and their livelihood, the fact is that we're headed towards legalization, and any numbers that are instituted ought to reflect a glide path towards that. In that respect, tomorrow night, Chair Pozanski, the Joint Committee on Public Safety is going to be hearing House Bill 3194, where there's a proposal to increase substantial quantity for the felony sentencing guideline purposes from 150 grams to a kilo, 2.2 pounds, and to reduce the ranking for no prior involvement from a crime severity 8, which is a presumptive prison sentence, to a crime severity 4, which is a presumptive probation sentence. So although in the abstract talking about, you know, between a pound and 4 ounces ought to be a misdemeanor and a pound ought to be a felony seems like a huge increase, it's not in the context of our trying to fashion a glide path towards legalization and taking into account and recognizing what 3194 would do, the Public Safety Commission's recommendation about sentencing guidelines. I know it seems odd to talk about misdemeanor marijuana or misdemeanor hashish, but the fact is that 35 states have misdemeanor marijuana provisions and 7 states have misdemeanor hashish provisions. Alaska's less than 6 grams, Indiana less than 2 grams, Pennsylvania 8 grams or under, Montana a gram, New Hampshire 5 grams or less, North Carolina 20th of an ounce or less. In Ohio, they differentiate between a solid form of hashish and the oil or the honey oil. If it's more than 5 grams or less than 10 grams of the solid, it's a misdemeanor. If it's less than 2 grams of the liquid. And I wanted to just let you know what some neighboring states are doing. California actually is similar to Oregon. It's a violation and then it's a felony unless it's a violation within 1,000 feet of a school and it's a misdemeanor. But Idaho has a misdemeanor provision less than 3 ounces. Washington, which recently legalized, before they legalized, it was 40 grams. And those crazy liberals in Utah, it's a misdemeanor if it's less than a pound. So if we were to adopt the proposal, if the legislature were to adopt the proposal that Compassionate Oregon is making, it would bring us in line with Utah in terms of misdemeanor possession. So in closing, two things. The first thing is, I guess three things. The first thing is that if we're going to have a misdemeanor proposal, the tier should be there should only be one tier. There's widespread agreement on that, and it ought to be at a B for the reasons I've described. The second thing is that Compassionate Oregon is less concerned about what the numbers actually are. But we do think that they should make some sense or have some relevance or have some connection to some reality other than, you know, the political reality of what would pass or not pass or whatever. It should be referenced to something. And in that regard, and having the reason for Measure 40 is that there are, patients who grow for themselves, who have the right number of plants, but some get too tall over the weekend, and they're lodged in a jail on a Class A felony, and they can't be released by the jail, and the bail is twice what it would otherwise be, and that's the reason for an A to a B, and the B to a C on the possession charge. It just makes sense, consistent with the rescheduling from Schedule 1 to Schedule 2, and I don't think there's any opposition anywhere to that. And so the last thought I want to leave you with is to please not craft an amendment that's going to jeopardize that core reform, because as modest as it is, it's important and it dramatically affects the lives of real people. So thank you so much.
Thank you. Questions?
My point of clarification, Mr. Chair, I haven't been able to read the dash for you because I'm having technology problems, but my understanding is that it would put the misdemeanor at 4 ounces.
Yes.
Not at 8.
That's mine. I think that's okay.
Mr. Chair, if I could inquire, the dash 4, would that be an A misdemeanor or a B misdemeanor at 4 ounces?
I think it would be B.
I have it up right here.
I think I saw it last night, if I remember correctly. I think.
But it just did one tier, and that was 4.
Could I inquire as well? Does it include since you've separated out in the dash 1 hashish that's marijuana from marijuana that's not hashish, is there also a misdemeanor hashish provision? Or are we just going to, any amount of hashish is going to be a B felony?
I think I was focused on marijuana.
Well, I would encourage, Chair Przanski, members of the committee, I would encourage you to adopt whatever provision it is that you whatever number you seize on as a misdemeanor level below which it's a misdemeanor, one quarter of that ought to be a misdemeanor for marijuana that's hashish.
Okay. Any other questions?
I can go there.
Yeah. Any other questions for this panel? We got another panel I want to call up. Thank you very much for coming forward.
Thank you.
Our next panel will be Katie Shiver and Steve Buckstein. While they're coming forward, is there anyone else who will want to give testimony on Senate Bill 40? All right. Steve, I think I'm going to let you go first, and Katie, if you'll follow up.
Thank you. Good morning, Chair Przanski and members of the committee. I'm Steve Buckstein. I'm Senior Policy Analyst and Founder of Cascade Policy Institute in Portland. We're a nonprofit, nonpartisan think tank. I provided you with a commentary that I recently updated that I actually wrote about 10 years ago titled Conservatives Should Oppose the War on Drugs. And it applies to people who aren't conservatives. I wrote it for a conservative magazine. That's why the title, and I felt I shouldn't change it. But it's basically an argument why all of us should oppose the war on drugs. And I see SB 40 as a step in that direction. Some of the testimony from the gentleman sitting right here, I think I would definitely agree with. I understand that this bill, as I understand it, this bill simply realigns penalties based on perceived harm. And I thought it included increasing penalties on methamphetamine. I may be wrong, but to the extent that it reduces penalties on use or manufacture of marijuana, I think it's a very good idea. I don't have recommendations as to the specifics because, again, I like the terminology I heard a few minutes ago, a glide path towards legalization. Anything that reduces the penalties, I think, is a good idea. If it includes increasing penalties for some other drugs, I would not think that is such a good idea. As a matter of public policy, I want to make it clear that I don't want the state to support or oppose the use or manufacture of any drug. As a libertarian, I think such decisions should be left up to free adults, not to the state to make those determinations. I hold the same position with regard to alcohol, gambling, and tobacco, which addict the state to their tax revenues as much as they addict addicts or addict their users. This afternoon, I'll be testifying in favor of the bill that, again, was mentioned here previously, HB 3371, before the House Judiciary Committee, which would be, in effect, legalization. I have some problems with the details, but basically, I think a huge step in the right direction. It is coming, I think, to the extent that your committee can look at this bill in that light, I think that would be good, and any other bills that move us in that direction and end what I think is a disastrous war on drugs in this country will be a good idea. Thank you.
Thank you. Katie?
Thank you. Senator Przanski, I appreciate it, and members of the committee, my name is Katie Suver. I'm a deputy district attorney in Marion County here on behalf of the Oregon District Attorneys Association. The original version of Senate Bill 40, the ODA, does not oppose. Obviously, in 2009, when the legislature directed the Board of Pharmacy to reschedule marijuana, it chose to reschedule marijuana as a Schedule II controlled substance, and this would be consistent with our other drug laws. I have not seen the Dash 1 or Dash 4 amendments, although Mr. Berger was kind enough to show me essentially what the Dash 1 amendments do. And as I understand it, they would effectively insert into the bill different degrees, whether felony or misdemeanor, based on quantities of marijuana. For the better part of my 15-plus years as a prosecutor, I was a narcotics prosecutor. I prosecuted mid and upper level and sometimes street level drug dealers. And I don't necessarily come armed with a lot of statistics, but I come with a lot of experience and a lot of anecdotal evidence. And what that has indicated to me is that most drug offenses, particularly drug delivery charges, are proven by circumstantial evidence. And the biggest circumstantial evidence we look to is the quantity of drug that the person possesses. Is it consistent with personal use or is it not consistent with personal use? So when we're talking about a person who is found in possession of 8 ounces or a half a pound of marijuana, that is not law enforcement or prosecution's opinion consistent with a personal use amount. So these cases are likely going to be charged as delivery of marijuana in any event. What we currently have under Oregon law is a system where a person in possession of more than an ounce of marijuana can be charged with a Class B felony. The court has and will continue to have discretion, regardless of the district attorney's position, to treat that as a misdemeanor up front or at the end of probation, as we sometimes see. And that isn't going to change. Even if a person had a pound of marijuana in their possession and the sole charge for the court's determination was possession of marijuana, the court would have the discretion to treat that as a misdemeanor up front. So what I can tell you is that when we get into differentiating quantities of marijuana, the District Attorney's Association is going to oppose making that differentiation, because as the current law stands, the court has in its discretion the ability to take out of the felony world something and place it in the misdemeanor world. I'll also point out that the amendments, as I understand them, that would create Class B misdemeanors, I think it's important to understand that when a person is convicted of a Class B misdemeanor, that does not reflect anything on their criminal history score if that person was later convicted of a felony. Under those felony sentencing guidelines, the only crimes that count towards calculating a person's criminal history score are Class A misdemeanors or felony crimes. So a person could have, and I'm admittedly being an exaggeration here, a person could have 10 Class B misdemeanor convictions, and it would appear under a felony sentencing guideline charge that they've never had a criminal conviction, because they would be an I on the sentencing guidelines. So I think it's something that the committee should keep in its mind as it considers these amendments and the necessity to have the amendments. I would say that the DA's Association, if the committee wants to consider amendments regarding amounts, we would ask as well that those amendments reflect hash and specifically quantities of hash and not just deal with marijuana. I guess the only other comment that I would like to make, if I may, is just sort of in response to Mr. Berger's reference to other states in the United States. Just the states that I heard him list off use gram amounts. You know, I think I heard 6 grams or 1/20th of an ounce as violation amounts. Oregon has long had a policy that a person in possession of less than 1 ounce of marijuana that they are not selling or delivering is guilty of no more than a violation. And that quantity is significantly larger still than other states who require it to be far less. So I believe that Oregon's current policies and laws regarding marijuana are appropriate. And we would oppose any of the current DASH amendments, but the bill in its original form we do not oppose. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions?
Yeah. Just a curiosity to Mr. Buckstein. I'm wondering if you saw the same firing line program I did where Buckley opined on the subject, years ago, obviously.
Chair Przanski, Senator Cruz, I did, but I also knew Bill Buckley a little bit when I was at Oregon State. He came and spoke, and we talked about this. And, you know, he's a conservative icon who, for personal reasons, became opposed to the war on drugs, and I don't think there have to be personal reasons. I think there are policy reasons also.
I mean, this is 30 years ago, something like that, mm-hmm. I think. I found it intriguing. Ms. Chair, the Dash 4 is our mind, and the reason I went to 4 is, you know, an ounce of marijuana is not what it was when we were kids. And I mean, that's the reality of it, and the more I thought about it, having too many steps in this is probably more confusing than not, and I thought that was an appropriate point of departure, so okay. It's up to the committee.
All right. Any other questions or comments? Thank you all very much for coming forward. Again, is there anyone else who'd like to give testimony today on Senate Bill 40? Not seeing anyone, we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 40. We're now going to go ahead and open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 82, and it looks like Mike, why don't you go through that? It looks like we have two people for that.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 82 is a bill that would have made supplying contraband a B felony. There has been an amendment that's replaced the original measure. It exempts possession of less than an ounce of marijuana conviction from the requirement that a court suspend the person's license for 6 months.
All right. I have Daryl Fuller and Aaron Jeffers signed up to give testimony.
You can take my name off the list.
Okay.
And I was unaware of the amendment, but I'd like to testify on that.
Come on up, Lee. And while they're coming up, is there anyone else who believes they might want to testify on Senate Bill 82?
You're 82.
82. Aaron?
Chair Brzezinski, members of the committee, Aaron Jeffers for the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. Thank you for allowing me to testify on Senate Bill 82 today. We would like to express our support for the Dash 1 amendment to Senate Bill 82. Just a little background on that. Possession of less than an ounce of marijuana is a violation, not a crime in Oregon. And because of that, the right to an attorney doesn't apply unless there are other crimes charged with that violation. So most people aren't going to hire an attorney just to fight the violation or even contest the violation in court. What that means is they're not going to be aware that they have the ability to ask the court not to impose the 6 months driver's license suspension that comes along with that violation. Because the judge has to find compelling reasons not to impose a suspension, that means that suspension is essentially going to be automatic when it's uncontested. So it is a good policy that possession of less than an ounce of marijuana is not a crime, but the driver's license suspension provision has not reflected that policy. We think Senate Bill, the Dash 1 to 82, would correct that imbalance when it comes to the driver's license suspensions. Happy to answer any questions.
All right. Thank you. Lee?
Chair Brzezinski, members of the committee, Leland Berger. I am a lawyer in practice 30 years this month. I live and work in Senator Shields and Representative Frederick's district in inner northeast Portland, but I practice statewide, including representing people statewide on less than an ounce of marijuana. And it's challenging in my practice because often the amount of work as a defense lawyer to defend against a less than an ounce ticket is the same as if it were a pound or 10 pounds or 100 pounds. And I can't obviously charge that amount, and I charge what the ticket is if I actually have to try the case, but almost always my involvement precipitates from the concern that the judge won't make a finding of compelling circumstances to not impose the driver's license suspension. Additionally, I can't begin to tell you how many calls I get. You know, I sent in the money, I thought it was a traffic ticket, and I get a notice from DMV that my license is suspended. What can you do about this? And the answer is not much. And then the third thing I wanted to tell you about this provision generally, you may recall, those of you who have been here for a while, that this was imposed when the Congress threatened to withhold highway funds absent imposition of this suspension for all controlled substances offenses. And Oregon responded, in addition to creating the safe harbor for compelling circumstances, with a sense of the legislature bill, and I can't remember whether it was a House or Senate joint memorial, to Congress complaining about what functionally was this extortion. And the good news is that there is language in the so-called Obamacare opinion, in the Chief Justice Roberts' opinion, suggesting that it may be unconstitutional. Specifically, Roberts explains that, the Chief Justice explains that there has to be some rational relationship between something the feds are commandeering the state to do in response to, or to be able to be to have federal funds available to it, you know, and the, what the federal funds are about. And it's an open question, I think, whether a simple less than an ounce ticket, which comes up, frankly, frequently when people are fishing or hiking or not driving at all, has anything to do with one's driver's license privileges. So I can't begin to describe to you how thrilled I am to see this amendment, and I want to thank the committee for it, and I hope it goes through quickly and easily. Thanks very much.
Senator Cruz.
Yeah, thank you. Lee, do you have a copy of the Dash 1 in front of you?
I've seen it, but...
Okay, I was looking for the pronunciation of the last word on line 9.
Is it avoirdupois?
Huh?
Is it about an ounce? Is it
No, it's...
Yes, you're right.
Avoirdupois.
Avoirdupois.
Yeah.
Can you come up with something that's like in English?
I think you just.
If we could have more than 4 ounces on the other bill, I think we could.
Bois du trois. Okay.
That's the language from 1972 okay. when neither of us were here.
Well, I appreciate it. I was struggling trying to figure out how to. So it's French in origin.
It is obviously French in origin.
Okay, thank you.
That's all I have to say. Thank you.
All right. Thank you all very much. Is there anyone else who wants to give testimony today on Senate Bill 82? All right, we'll close the public hearing. Close the public hearing on Senate Bill 82.
Okay.
And we're going to go ahead and open up a public hearing on 409. Mike?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 409 requires the district attorney to apply to the court for a protective order whenever material depicts a child in a state of nudity or sexual conduct.
Okay, we have, looks like, four individuals who want to give testimony today, and it looks like a panel has been requested. Judge, is it Silman? I cannot read the last name.
Sealander.
And Lisa
Ludwig,
and Gail Meyer. That I can read. Going to lead off, or do we want the Honorable Sealander?
Go ahead. I'll go first. Thank you. Chair Pozdanski, members of the committee, Gail Meyer, on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. Senate Bill 409 is an effort to be proactive in resolving a dispute that is occurring in the different counties right now. And that is how to address discovery when evidence in a criminal case involves visual depictions or audio recordings of a victim in a state of nudity or engaged in sexually explicit conduct. These are not always child pornography cases, although that's what immediately comes to mind, but they also just simply have photos, perhaps, of young minor children that do show intimate body parts in a state of nudity. And how to be maximally protective of those materials in the course of the discovery process, but also provide equal access to both the prosecution and the defense. The dispute that's erupted in the counties is that the district attorneys have been asking the counties for orders depriving the defense from getting copies of these materials, but insisting instead that the defense and the defense expert review them in a law enforcement custodial facility. This bill attempts to be proactive because there's an equal number of other courts that are doing the other, which is to issue these protective orders. And Senate Bill 409 would mandate a protective order in all instances of cases with this sensitive material on it. This issue has come up in other states. The state of Washington has resolved this by way of requiring a mandatory protective order. And New Hampshire's legislature looked at the issue not too long ago. They also opted for a mandatory protective order. And other states have as well. This mandatory protective order has very tight terms. Currently, there are protective orders that are being issued for these kinds of materials. But Senate Bill 409 really has tighter terms and more particular, and I think the one that is of maximal interest for maximal privacy protection is that at the end of the case, both the expert and the defense lawyer, or the expert and the prosecuting attorney, have to return any copies that have been given to them to the facility from which they received it, so back to police custody. If there's any need to preserve this stuff for appeal, that would be the subject of a separate order by the court. But the original process of making copies available to both the defense and the prosecution would require the attorneys to be responsible for certifying that everything is back now into the original facility from which they came. That gives the assurances that the stuff isn't out there and unaccounted for many years later. Particularly with respect to computer crimes, the reason this is so difficult is because the IT forensic computer experts need to spend long hours running programs over these mirrored images of the hard drives that can require really detailed equipment, manuals, and take a lot of time. And to that end, I've introduced for you, passed around this affidavit for a search warrant, and it's highlighted at the back. This is a forensic computer specialist, examiner, for a law enforcement agency explaining to the court why I need to seize this computer rather than look at it in a cursory manner on site in a residence. And this is an affidavit where the examiner is saying, this process of sorting through this stuff can take weeks or months depending on the volume of data. And it's for that same reason, really, that the defense expert also needs to have that a mirrored image of the hard drive available to the expert. One more point, and then I'll turn it over to those who are handling this at the ground level. There was a case in Baker County where the attorney agreed that the computer could be held in the FBI laboratory in Portland. And the attorney was attempting to be accommodating for that process and agreed to allow that to happen. That resulted in probably about an additional $5,000 in defense expert witness costs over it would have been had it been a mirrored image copy available to the expert in Baker County. It also resulted in a delay in trial. And the reason is that when the expert on the case attempted to make time and make an appointment with the evidence custodian in the FBI, he had to wait a month to get in, and then he underestimated the time he needed, and so to get back in there for more work, he had to get back in queue again. So the costs in overnight stay and in travel, and then the defense attorney also getting out to Portland and whatnot, it racked up the costs again, additionally about an extra $5,000, and these were indigent defense costs. And it also delayed the trial. So we think the mandatory protective order, which has been, again, the method resolved that State of Washington, New Hampshire, and others, is the appropriate way of proceeding. And happy to answer any questions. With me today is Lisa Ludwig. She's a criminal defense lawyer who's fresh from the trenches on this issue. And also Judge Seelander, who has some additional comments for the committee.
Thank you. Whoever's going to go next.
Go ahead. All right. Good morning, Chair Przanski, members of the committee. My name is Lisa Ludwig, and I'm a private practice criminal defense attorney now, although I've been doing this for 17 years as a public defender. Now I have a mixture of state and federal cases, both appointed and retained in both state and federal courts, and many of my cases involve cases where I seek funding from the state or federal government for the expenses of the case. I handle a lot of cases that involve digital evidence, everything from child pornography cases to cases where the allegation is sexting, for example, where one 17-year-old might be sending a partially nude photo of herself to another teenager. And also examples where the issue in the case isn't necessarily pornography or sexting at all, but computers, by their nature, sometimes contain photographs, even family photographs, that include nudity. All those would fall under the category of digital material that has nudity on it. One of the issues in a lot of the cases is the provenance of the evidence. In other words, trying to figure out who put something on a computer and when it was placed there, who looked at it, who legally possessed it. And so many times the purpose of examination is not to determine whether something is pornography or not, but to figure out who had access to this computer, which is something that an expert can tell by going through the hard drive very carefully, running programs, looking at the information behind the information and data that's been deleted or overwritten. When trials happen, these images, these
for example, pornographic images, nude images, explicit images, are often made available to the wider public, which I know is a concern under the Adam Walsh Act and those who are worried about it at the state level. They're made available to court staff, to jurors, to members of law enforcement, the sheriff's department, that sort of thing, and members of the public in the courtroom. So when trials happen, these images are often published to a wider audience as part of the process of a trial. The sentences in these cases can be huge, and many times my clients, the criminal defendants, are unfamiliar with the criminal process. They've never had contact with law enforcement before, and they're looking at sometimes up to a life sentence or many, many years in prison. And in order for these cases to settle, in other words, to resolve in a criminal compromise, they have to be thoroughly investigated and handled. When the defense team can do a complete and thorough investigation and the client can understand that all of their rights have been pursued and observed as much as possible, that leads more likely to settlement. And that means that all the materials have to be examined by an expert. As Ms. Meyer already said, courts around the state have ruled differently. Washington County has said yes and no. Yamhill County, as far as I know, has said yes to access with a protective order. Clackamas County so far has said no, although it's only been ruled on once that I know of. Benton County has said yes and given access. Linn County has said yes and given access. And the requests are pending in Lincoln and Jackson County, as far as I know. The protective orders that I'm aware of have included 17 detailed points laying out exactly what has to be done with the evidence and all the different ways that it has to be protected by the defense team and the expert before it will be turned over by law enforcement under those circumstances. And one of those points, of course, is what Ms. Meyer mentioned, the requirement that at the end of the case, it's wiped clean and returned to law enforcement so it's never disseminated outside of the defense function. To my knowledge, those protective orders have been very effective, and of course the lawyer is responsible under penalty of contempt and their bar card for violation of those protective orders. The big difference in these cases often is the time available to do the examination, and time of experts costs a lot of money. Some of these computer experts charge more than I do on an hourly basis. I'll not get into that, but it's a lot. It is very common in especially digital evidence cases for the government to come in, the state or the federal government, and seize the evidence months or even years before they bring a criminal charge because it takes the government so long to do the analysis. And of course, they've got caseloads and they have other things pending, but they spend literally weeks, months, sometimes even years analyzing all the data on these hard drives before they charge the defendant and make that evidence available to the criminal defendant. Then the clock starts, and the guidelines in Oregon require that in a, for example, a sex case, the guideline limit for the time from arraignment to trial should be 150 days. 6 months sounds like a lot of, or actually 5 months sounds like a lot of time in an ordinary case, but when the government has had the evidence for 8 months, and then the defense only has 5 months to have it examined by an expert and prepare to negotiate and or to have a trial, there's a big disparity in defense access versus government access. The evidence is in custody of literally dozens of different agencies, everything from the FBI, Homeland Security, all the way to the Tualatin Police Department. Small agencies like Milwaukee PD, agencies that in order to give a defense expert access have to take time and resources out of their staff and budgets to have someone available to copy the evidence but then stand by and be physically present on the premises, which means you're probably taking an officer or a detective off the street for all of the hours that you're also paying for a defense expert to be on the premises to do the examination. And not only does that lead to scheduling problems, but it also leads to budget problems for these small agencies, as well as, of course, budget problems for indigent defense. There are issues of physical space, of computers that can be brought in, of internet access on the premises, which is sometimes necessary, of having to bring in extra people, which has happened in a recent case of mine where it started out with a cost estimate of one amount, and when it became necessary to go to the premises of the police department, the cost to the state of Oregon, the judicial department for an indigent client, more than doubled. It required two guys, and more than twice the amount of time at that hourly rate. I'm happy to answer any questions you have about the particulars and the specifics or examples in these cases, since I've had several of them and I've kind of done an informal survey of my colleagues.
Thank you. Judge Sealander.
Thank you, Chair Przanski, members of the committee. My name is Robert Sealander. I'm a retired circuit court judge from Clackamas County. I'm on senior status with the state of Oregon. During the time I was actively on the bench, I was the only judge that served on the Attorney General's Victims Rights Act Compliance Committee. That was the committee that put into action all of the rights that were voted on as a constitutional amendment by the voters. I believe strongly in the rights of victims. It is interesting, the courts and legislatures are often asked to balance competing interests. Here, the balancing is the rights and privacy interests of the victims and the right to a fair trial process by the defendant. The stakes are high. If a defendant is convicted of one of these criminal offenses, their life will be affected forever. Not just a lengthy prison sentence, but most often sexual sex offender registration. I believe that justice is most secure when it is put through the grist mill of our adversarial system. And we're talking about visual depictions. When I began the practice of law in 1972, we talked about photographs. We would hand photographs to a witness and we would ask whether it was a true and accurate representation of what it purported to be. Most often the answer was yes, and it was easy to believe them because pictures back then were hard to manipulate. That is no longer the case. Every day we see something on TV that never happened, where we see a character who has never existed. Anybody who has the computer or a telephone has the ability to manipulate any photograph. And if you've ever picked up one of these books on pick out the 18 things that have changed from one picture to another, you know how difficult it is to know what those changes are. So the question in some circumstances is when, how, and under what circumstances the visual depiction were taken or how it's changed. And the ability of the defense to fully vet visual depictions under the carefully crafted constraints of the court is essential. Now, I want to make it clear, I don't think Senate Bill 409 gives the court the ability it does not already have. I think the courts have the ability to put a restrictive order on defendants and on their attorneys on how these materials can be utilized or how they can be viewed. What 409 does is two things. Number one, it creates a statewide consistency. I think that's important for everyone. And as a judge that is now visiting many counties in the state, it's interesting how lack of consistent courts are from county to county. The other thing it does is underline the ability of the court that we already have to make sure that our protective orders are enforced. If somebody violates it, the consequences are severe. We can do it through contempt, we can fine, we can imprison, but I think to most attorneys, more importantly, the attorney can be suspended or disbarred. We regularly issue orders of this type, not necessarily on visual depictions, and it's my experience that they are regularly complied with. So in conclusion, I think number one, this is a good balance. It does allow this to go through the grist mill of the adversarial process, and it also provides statewide consistency. I was going to say in my introduction, I'm not appearing on behalf of the Judicial Department. Just as a disclaimer, I am Executive Director of the Yamhill Defense Consortium. Though I do not consider myself on the defense side, I'm not appearing on behalf of the OCDLA. I am appearing on those who are concerned about sleep deprivation. As a judge who has imposed sentences of life, For me to go home and sleep at night comfortably, it's comforting to know that the system has been adversarial, that the defense has been able to underturn or overturn all the things they want to by looking at the evidence. But there's another interesting conclusion. 95% of all cases result in guilty pleas. They don't result in trials. The more an attorney can sit down with a criminal defendant with the pictures in front of both of them, no matter how repulsive that may seem, the more likely it is the defendant's not going to be able to say, I didn't do it, they're not mine, or I didn't have them. I think the end result is that we will continue to have guilty pleas that are well-founded based on investigation and evidence. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions for the panel? Yes, in their close.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Judge Sealander, can you just tell me a little bit about process? The district attorney can move for this, but they have the option right now. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Senator Close, I think the process right now is the district attorney's acts or denies access to the information. And so the defense attorney most often comes in and says, I need the information, but I will be subject to a protective order. District attorneys can come in and ask for a protective order. I don't think that's the process. I think generally they want to protect the information and not disclose it at all. So my experience is it's the defense more than the district attorney. This just ensures that a protective order is in place and that discovery material that should be disclosed is disclosed in a way that's safe to everybody.
Okay, so you're saying they do have the option right now if they want to do that. The district attorney does have the option, but you're saying they would be not likely to do it?
Well, I think Ms. Ludwig described the situation. We have conflicting rulings in the state of Oregon, and apparently the most recent one out of Clackamas County is that free access to the material under a protective order was not allowed.
So your answer is yes.
My answer is yes.
Okay. Thank you. One thing that concerns me in the bill, there's no time limit. Would the judge put a time limit on such an order that the hard drive would be out there out of the state's custody?
At the conclusion.
I think you're asking, excuse me, Senator Close, I think you're asking two different questions. The protective order allows for the examination of the material at a place or at a location that's secure but is under the control of the defense attorney. The return of the material or the end of the protective order is at the conclusion of the criminal trial. So while courts normally will tell the district attorney and the defense attorney when the trial is going to be, 6 months down the line or 4 months down the line, and that puts a limit on how much time they have to investigate. We don't tell them that they only have 30 days to investigate this material. So the end of the trial is when it has to be returned. They would have access up to and including through the trial to have the material and to investigate it.
Okay, and last one.
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So everything else that's on the hard drive, you know, I'd be concerned that that would be held out and private. Is there anything that would keep the defense from?
I'm sorry, I missed the first
looking
part
at material
of your question.
That isn't involved in the case. You know, they have the hard drive, right? Is that what you're saying? Of the computer.
Ms. Ludwig, why don't we let Ms. Ludwig, since she actually is a practitioner.
Mm-hmm. Chair Przanski, Senator Close, in the vast majority of cases that I've handled, the digital evidence that's being examined belongs to the defendant. And so that which is being given to the defense is already material that the defendant, you know, owned or possessed, in theory at least, unless other people have had access to the computer, which is sometimes the issue. Computer experts usually say that, I should explain a little bit about the process. When the police sees a laptop, they take it to their lab, and before they do anything, they make a mirror image of the hard drive. It's better than a copy. It's a clone.
And so they can keep the original evidence in its perfect, intact state and never manipulate it, so they're never subject to accusations of manipulation. They work from a mirror image. And when they make the evidence available to the defense, they also make it, they make another mirror image, and they make it available to the defense expert to work with. That way, the original materials are always intact. I've asked whether it's possible to just take off the images and look at the rest of the computer sometimes. And what I've been told by law enforcement experts and also by private defense experts is that that isn't considered best practice in the computer community. They by trying to take one thing out, you corrupt the entire device, and then the evidence is no longer reliable. And so you never manipulate the original material. Instead, you have to kind of take it as a whole piece, examine the whole thing. And that's coming from the computer experts. Certainly, in cases, sometimes issues of privacy come up. I think that's why a protective order is important. We use protective orders traditionally and for a long time in cases that involve child abuse. There's agencies like CARES and the Children's Center who videotape interviews with small children describing very explicit, you know, accounts of sex abuse and that sort of thing. And those materials have always been available to the defense under this type of a protective order. And it's very important to be able to take that video and show it to your client and confront him with it and say, this is the evidence we're going to be seeing at trial. If, you know, the computer is just the same. You need to be able to take it, meet with your client privately, and say, if we go to trial, this is what the government is accusing you of. You can no longer cut yourself off from it, stick your head in the sand. You need to face it. That is a really important part of the defense function, especially in cases like this where you're dealing with clients who may be in denial, may be very sick, may be very inexperienced at the ways of the criminal justice system, may be engaging in what one lawyer calls magical thinking about the way that the case is going to go. And so it's so important to be able to, under very circumscribed processes, take that evidence and work with your client about it. And the protective orders in the CARES situations work well. I've never heard of a situation where they've gotten, where the materials have gotten released beyond the defense team. I don't know if anybody else can address that.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you all very much for coming forward. Becky Strauss is our last signed up witness for this bill. While she's coming up, is there anyone else who will want to testify on Senate Bill 409? Becky.
Good morning. Becky Strauss, Chair Przonski, members of the committee. My name is Becky Strauss. I'm here on behalf of the ACLU of Oregon. Just very briefly here to lend our support, echo the comments from OCDLA and others on the prior panel. We really think that Senate Bill 409 strikes the appropriate balance or takes the right approach where we're protecting privacy of those depicted in the sexually explicit material, but we're also making sure that the defense has the tools it needs to make sure that the system is working. I think that this is, as I said, this is necessary to make sure that the accused are having their due process protected as well as the privacy of those depicted in the materials. For that reason, we appreciate the comments, appreciate the hearing, and are in support of the bill.
Thank you. Any questions? Thank you very much.
Thank
We're
you.
Going to go ahead and close the public hearing on Senate Bill 409. Open up our last public hearing on Senate Bill 482. Mike?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 482 would add saliva to the list of fluids that are illegal to propel at public safety officers. There are two amendments out there. There's the Dash 1 amendment, which the first time we heard this, there was some concern about spitting at an officer versus it actually landing on the officer because of potentially a big fiscal that might carry. So the Dash 1 addresses that concern by making it the aggravated harassment where the saliva comes into physical contact with the public safety officer. The Dash 2 amendment takes into account some of the testimony we heard talking about
the intent behind someone trying to spit at an officer, which might be if they have a dangerous communicable disease, and if they know that they have that and then spit, that would make it an aggravated harassment, even if they're just spitting at and it's not actually landing on the officer. So that's the difference between the two different amendments.
Okay. Clarification?
So what if they don't know that they have it? I mean, how do you prove knowingly?
That's a good point. The dash two would require, as I read it, for the first time this morning, that the person know that they had it, and that's why they were doing it. It would not be strict liability, and you'd have to prove that they knew it, which would probably come through an exclamatory statement or admission after the fact if they were in the mood to talk.
Or if there are some type of, let's say, medical records that deem that they knew it.
Well,
so here's what we're going to do on this. Let's just stay calm here. So what we're going to do is take the testimony. We're not going to move the bill today because we have two amendments that are here. And for the chair's perspective, I've not gone through the dash two. I want to go through these. We'll carry this over for future consideration in a work session. But let's go ahead and get the testimony. Daryl, once you come up, I think you may be the only one that's currently scheduled for Senate Bill 482. Was there anyone else who wanted to give testimony today? I don't know if I should or if I really want to in the back of the room. So, Mary, if you'd like to come up, just realize this. I have one member who's going to have to leave here very shortly, and so I want to make sure we conclude the testimony. Daryl, once you start off, and Mary, if you want to come up and join them.
Mr. Chair, Daryl Fuller on behalf of the Oregon State Sheriff's Association. I have seen the dash ones briefly, have not seen the dash twos either. I want to testify in support of the general concept of including saliva in terms of the things in it. Right now, the statute lists blood, urine, semen, and feces. Adding the term saliva to that list in terms of a dangerous substance that can be propelled towards either a corrections officer or a law enforcement officer. And I'd be happy to look at both amendments and to work with the chair on the most appropriate ones or both to add to the bill. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Okay, let's just get clarification. Right now, the statute says for corrections officers, they are protected from saliva. Yeah, okay. Saliva is really for the uniformed officers out on the street. This is something that came to my attention in my private work as a prosecutor as to when we're looking at how we're going to charge someone out. The officer originally charged as aggravated, and then I looked at the statute because I hadn't had a case like that recently and realized that we either had an oversight or we intentionally left out saliva as it pertained to officers in the field. So this is really what we're looking at working on. And then when we had testimony before, the question was, I guess, the situation of whether some actually intended to spit on someone or not. And that's where we kind of left it as to determining whether we wanted to require the intentional act as compared to someone that may be vocally expressing themselves and having saliva coming out of their mouth, not intentionally spitting. That's the way I remember how we left it. So with that, Mary?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Mary Botkin with AFSCME for the record. I needed to understand the difference between just saliva and bodily fluids. I thought one was the same as the other. I now understand we have a couple of small police departments that probably would benefit from the passage of this bill. And so, you know, obviously we'll support it, but it does not, as you have explained, it does not affect the bulk of our membership that is covered under the public safety statute. So thank you, Mr. Chair, for the explanation.
You betcha. My pleasure. Any questions? Thank you all very much. Is there anyone else who wants to give testimony on Senate Bill 482? Not seeing anyone, we're going to go ahead and close the public hearing on 482. And we're going to... I got this correct. Can I both things over? Because by then we'll know which world we're going to go under. All right. So what the chair is going to do on Senate Bill 409, as well as Senate Bill 482, we will carry those over to next week, next Tuesday, which is the 9th of April. Regarding the bills that we had before, we will go ahead and schedule them accordingly based on everyone having an opportunity to review it. Senator Cruz and I are going to talk about Senate Bill 40 and 82 at this point. And on Senate Bill 30, the chair at this point, unless committee members think differently, feel that we need to have an amendment that will allow the court the discretion to determine whether or not someone should be required onto the registry. It seemed to me, based on what I heard from the testimony today, that that would be a step that would allow for both sides getting the opportunity to have this go forward. So we'll work on that as well. All right. Is there any other work for today? All right. Bill, you're coming in. Do we need to do anything before we gavel out? All right. We're going to close the hearing for today. We're scheduled to be here tomorrow at 8:45.
You can never settle on a time, can you?
Well, there's things that happen in Douglas County that sometimes you just have to be available at 8:30, if you know what I mean.
That's true.
With that, we're closed.